Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And just before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big good morning, cheerio, to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NERS, or listening via the app and also our website, 989fm.com.au. You can listen to us from our website, as also around the country or around the world. So good morning to everybody tuning in. Joining me in the studio first, we'll introduce our former Let's Talk host, current CEO, Carl Watson.
I've got a promotion.
Yeah.
Good morning, bro.
For our listeners as well, Carl, your mob in the country, please.
Mob in country, my mob are Birriggaba and Kungaloo people of central Queensland, but born and raised here in Brisbane.
Deadly. And Dean, tell us the same thing, brother, your mob and your country.
Yeah, thanks, Bo. Great to be here. Mob are the Quandamooka peoples from Mindiraba or North Stradbroke Island, as other people know it. But I grew up in central Queensland and went to boarding school and university down here in Brisbane as well.
Whereabouts up in central Queensland?
I grew up in a little coal mining town called Moranbah. Right. So Dad was in the coal mines up there.
Is that around your central
that's
Queensland?
Another country, yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's down the road from Nebo too, eh?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Just up the road.
That's Wirri country, that's old grandfather, yeah.
What'd you study?
I studied a Bachelor of Arts, Politics and Journalism. That was a bit of a roundabout route. I started doing a different degree first, but I started doing an exercise management course, but I should have remembered that I wasn't very good at science when I was at high school, and so I went and got into a science degree in my first year and ended up driving pizzas by the end of that year, throwing the whole thing in. So I decided to change and follow my passion, or follow the things I was interested in.
Which wasn't pizza?
Which wasn't, well, I still do actually, unfortunately. Yeah. It's not working for me either. It's a one-way relationship. Followed my passion in terms of politics and journalism and writing and understanding how power works. I think from a very early age that was something that I was quite interested in.
And what was that interest in politics?
Well, I think it just has such an enormous impact on our people. I remember writing my first political essay when I was 7, writing about land rights. Yeah, and that's something that was driven by my mother. Dad also, as a non-Indigenous person, supported us and made sure that we were, did everything he possibly could to connect us with our mob. But Mum really made sure that we understood our culture, even though we lived away from home. She would tell us stories. She would take us back as often as she possibly could, and really opened our eyes to injustice and power. And that's something that never leaves you. I don't think it leaves any of us as mob.
Definitely. Our conversation that we're going to have is also about that sort of question you asked about power as well. But I'll just, like, we'll get to that. What was you going to say, Carl?
No, I was going to say, full disclosure, Dean Parkin's my brother-in-law. So there's a bit of jest.
It's all good nature.
And mind you, Steph's in the background of yourself. If she's feeling anything.
She'll fill in any...
She'll keep us both in line, whatever you mean.
I just want to attest to the Mum Ev, very strong and powerful woman.
Deadly. After university, where did that sort of lead you?
Yeah, so I did some work in the Queensland Public Service. My very first job out of university was working with the Department of Main Roads, worked in some of the stuff they were doing around cultural heritage. Went into a ministerial office then. My local member at the time, Lydia Clark, was Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Policy, DATSIP. And that was a really interesting experience. I think I was 2 weeks into the job and, the Palm Island and the terrible things that were inflicted on the people there happened in 2 weeks into that job, and I got to see close up politics, decision-making, in a time that was a really dark moment for our mob and our history, I think, as a country, Palm Island. So thrown into the deep end, straight into the fire, and So
it was too, like, a very, very, yeah, like, powerful time for our mob, very dark time, because I think not so long before that as well, TJ Hickey happened, and sort of the same similar thing that happened on Palm happened down there in Redfern as well. Yeah, so, yeah, like, yeah, I just wanted to...
Yeah, but you got to remember too, like, we remember that time like it wasn't that... like it was a long time ago, but it wasn't that far removed from the 90s.
No.
You know, like it was 2003 was like only, you know, almost only within a decade of, you know, another death in custody in here in West End, you know, and all the death in custody marches and rallies throughout the 90s and mid 90s. Like it wasn't too far from that time, you know. Yeah. And today, you know, we still see it. But I think we forget about... Yeah, it was long ago, but it wasn't all that far removed from those, you know, those early 90s.
And I guess, like, around that time as well, there was a lot of shaping as well, you could say, as well, around that power dynamic that you sort of mentioned in your introduction, where you said, you know, like, you wrote this land rights piece. Yeah, like that was a very, very powerful time for our people, because, like, I remember in high school, man, like, that was, like, the biggest marches, like, we went to, and sometimes, like, we would wag school and come into it, which was pretty funny and pretty cool. But, yeah, like, tell us a bit about, you know, like you sort of mentioned that, you know, it was, like, a very dark and powerful time for our people.
Yeah, it was, you know, as Carl was talking about, it wasn't that far after the 90s, late 90s. I mean, I was at high school when Pauline Hanson was making her first run. And I remember, you know, I was also in high school when Native Title and that was going through, and I getting into fights and getting picked in fights because, you know, people thought we were going to steal their backyard, and it was a tough time to grow up as a teenager. It's really hard to understand truth. Lots of people were talking their own truth. A lot of people were talking a lot of nonsense about us as people too, from the outside, and so it was a really tough, confusing time growing up, and you felt in a lot of ways, you know. I was at a boarding school. There was 1,200 kids, and at the time, I understood to be the only Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander kid in that whole school. And so, you know, you grow a certain way of thinking about the world and saying there's a lot of injustice here, and you got a couple of choices. One, you can duck your head and hide, pretend it's not like that, or you can really start to think, well, how is it that I'm going to shape my life and shape my position to try and change that, and work with people that need our help. So it was a really formative time, growing up through that time. And
how long did you sort of stay in that space?
The politics space, I only stayed about 18 months, I think. And I think that was a good thing because you can get carried away with yourself. You're like a 24-year-old kid. Who is talking to ministers and director generals of departments, acting like you know what you're actually talking about, but you don't. And so, you know, you don't want to stay in there too long because you get it really is a bubble. And I see people that stay there for a very long time and they get a very warped understanding of how actually the rest of the world lives. But it was good to get that understanding of how decision-making is done in and around that political process. After that, I took off overseas for about 4 years. I went and lived in London.
Yeah, cool. What was going on over there?
Well, it was, let's just say it was the pursuit of romance. I was
having a good old time, though. Yeah, you had a good travel and seen a lot.
I really did. I lived in London. I travelled a lot through Europe. So I was fortunate to be in a position that I could take off for like a 4-day weekend. And, you know, you'd be in Spain for the weekend.
You'd
just be hanging out there, or France. And so, you know, and interestingly, as a different side of growing up and experience is it didn't matter that I was Aboriginal there. It's the first time in my life where being Aboriginal actually didn't mean anything in terms of work or whatever, because London is such a multicultural place. There's people from all over the world, and I wasn't a traditional owner there. I was, you know, a guest in that country, and that gives you a different perspective too. So that was a really interesting time, really great time. I loved my time out there.
Deadly. And I guess as of late, you've been involved in the discussions around the Statement from the Heart.
That's right.
The big meeting, I think it was about 300 Aboriginal people from all over the country.
Yeah, just over 250.
Just over 250, yeah.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, yeah.
And just for our listeners as well, could you sort of, the dialogue process before that, could you let us know?
Yeah, so there was a referendum council that was established to run a series of regional dialogues across the country, and the referendum council was made up of half Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and half non-Indigenous people. The real leaders of it, though, of the referendum council dialogue process, was Arnie Pat Anderson, Professor Megan Davis, a constitutional lawyer, and Noel Pearson were the three, I guess, three of the leaders that were really driving that referendum council process. I will say on that point, I think history's been very unkind and not dignified the contribution of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in the really significant battles.
Definitely.
I think we haven't given them the recognition and respect that we might have. And I think when history comes to write the story about Uluru Statement from the Heart, it'll be great that Arnie Pat and Megan will be recognised as the two leaders that really drove the process. They were the engine room that really drove the dialogue process. So what happened was before they did the formal dialogues, they did three kind of like workshops to work out how they'd actually run the process. And then we did a trial dialogue in Melbourne, and then we ran 12 regional dialogues. And what happened as a result of those three sort of preparation workshops was that the mob in those conversations that were held in Broome, Thursday Island and Melbourne decided on the makeup of the dialogue. So they said it should be 60% made up of traditional owners, 20% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the kind of the organisations, like the service organisations and whatnot that work in our communities, and 20% of people who didn't fit into those two categories but were, you know, important in in the conversations. So those 12 regional dialogues held across the country were according to that format in terms of the participants. There were convening organisations that were running it in those particular regions. So, for example, in the Kimberleys, the Kimberley Land Council would identify who those people were in that region according to that 60-20-20 formula, and they would invite them because they knew the people in their regions. And so they would be the ones that invite, and they were co-conveners. Those dialogues were about 2.5 days over the weekends, and I think, you know, in the easy dismissal that the Turnbull government gave of the referendum council's final report in the Uluru Statement, they don't appreciate that our mob, elders, young people from around the country gave up their weekends, left their families for the weekends to sit down and talk about constitutional reform and structural reform, like really tough issues to be talking about. But our mob were really like diligent and dedicated and we've been asked these questions many, many times in the past. None of this is new. We were being asked yet again to put all that out there and pour our cultural and intellectual capital into these conversations. And we did that. And we did that in a really fulsome way. So it was a very, very extensive process, very detailed process.
Definitely it was, yeah. And I guess especially the micromanagement of, different people sort of being a part of the big broader discussion that took part of that weekend or two or three days out there at in Uluru as well. Big, because like you said, you know, like you wanted to get the 60-20 sort of mix that you needed to get for it is to have sort of that, you know, dialogue that sort of represented the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. How hard was that part?
Yeah, look, it was a necessary part. It was hard, and there was robust discussion and in many cases disagreement, and it was important that we had that disagreement. It was important that we had those voices in the room. There were plenty of options being considered. There were five really key options that were being considered that had come from previous processes. As I said, we weren't recreating the wheel. A lot of this has been talked about before. But having those different voices in the room was really critical, and people were able to express their views on sovereignty, and they were able to express their views on not being recognised, and they were expressing their views with the dissatisfaction of the government and our relationship with the government and why should we be engaging with them. And then there were those who were really considering the benefits of being recognised and the benefits of being, talking about things like racial non-discrimination and binding the Commonwealth government, because at the moment the Commonwealth government doesn't have any restriction on its ability to pass racist laws.
Mm.
And a lot of people, and particularly in the Northern Territory, who had lived life under the intervention, were very strong on those points.
Definitely, definitely. And I guess like those sort of, you said like there was sort of frameworks or sort of like five different sort of things that you needed to work in and around. What were sort of like some of those discussions?
Yeah, yeah, I'm very happy to talk about those. So the five options came from two previous processes in particular, the 2012 Expert Panel on Constitutional Recognition and the 2015 Joint Select Committee that was headed up by Ken White and Nova Peris. And the five options that the Referendum Council took to each one of those dialogues were reforming Section 51, subsection 26 of the Constitution. That's otherwise known as the racist power. So that was the power that was the result of the 1967 referendum.
Mm-hmm.
That was the power that gave the Commonwealth the power to make laws about
based on the
based on race. You're right. Based on race. The language in the document says race.
And just like, where does the Northern Territory intervention sort of come in that discussion?
Well, that's much later. That was that used for? No, it was they suspended the Racial Discrimination Act. Yeah,
so like that wasn't a part of the Constitution, something to do with.
There are a couple of powers. One is the racist power that allows the Commonwealth to make laws with regards to race, and that power has only ever been used for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So things like the Native Title Act, for example, are possible because of that particular clause. The intervention, now I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but there are also powers within the Constitution that dictate the relationship between the Commonwealth government and the territories, which have a different relationship with the states. And I don't want to venture into the realm of constitutional law in detail and speculate, but I think there was some interaction there between racist power and the Commonwealth's ability to pass laws.
Megan's the foremost expert.
Megan Davis would be absolutely the person to speak to.
Professor Megan Davis.
So Section 5126, the problem that arises with that particular power is there is nothing in the Constitution at the moment that says that laws must be for the benefit of our mob. And in fact, the High Court has found in previous judgments that the Commonwealth government does not have to think about benefit. It can pass laws to our detriment if it likes.
Mm. Or the detriment of any other racial group for that matter.
They can, but as I said, that law, to my knowledge, has only ever been used against our mob. And sometimes in favour of our mob, like heritage laws and, as I said, native title, hang off that. So the question was being asked, should we put like a clause on there that says, for the benefit of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? But then the questions arise, who determines what benefit is? Because there's no trust in the Parliament, obviously, to make good decisions about that. They've quite clearly made many laws that aren't for our benefit. Or do we leave it to the High Court to interpret what benefit would look like? So there was some problems in and around that particular clause. So that was the first option. The second option, which is, as I alluded to before, was an insertion of a non-racial discrimination clause. So some sort of clause that would prevent the Commonwealth from making racially discriminatory laws.
Mm.
And as I said, in certain areas of the country, that was quite a popular power. That was quite a popular option because too many of our mob have lived under laws that are racially discriminatory and target us unfairly because of who we are. So that was the second option. Third option was some sort of statement of acknowledgement. People have referred to that as the preamble. There isn't a preamble in the Australian Constitution, but this idea of some form of words that would be inserted into the Constitution that would make some sort of acknowledgement of us as, you know, the First Peoples and having some sort of special connection to the country. It's fair to say that across the country and across those different dialogues, there was not a lot of support for that. In fact, it's fair to say there are quite a lot of people that were directly opposed to that, and probably for two reasons. The two reasons that I heard the most cited. One is that just a set of words like that won't change anything. Won't change a single thing for our mob. And two, there was a question of whether that would say something about our sovereignty. So having some sort of acknowledgement of us as peoples, as a statement of acknowledgement, whether that would say something. And as soon as those two things were talked about, people were quite against that as a proposal. The fourth proposal was the voice to Parliament. I want to make a point on that. It was said that it was this a late idea. It wasn't a late idea. It was talked about at the Kirribilli Statement in 2015, and had been talked about on a number of occasions before that. And this idea of self-determination and genuine representation for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples is something that our people have been fighting for many, many decades.
So this I guess that was like one of the biggest concerns, I guess, with like some of the mob that did attend it and sort of, I guess, go away with it, some of the mob that, like that sort of voice to the parliament, that representation, what was it, I guess the advisory side to it as well, like something that sort of, you know, because... it's like time and time again, you know, like that's as far as we get, you know, an advisory sort of discussion point to, you know, the powers to be.
Yeah, it was certainly raised as a concern. That's true. There are a couple of problems, and again, without sort of stepping into areas of law that I should have no business talking about, but it's very, very difficult to bind any parliament. We've got the democratic system of elected representation, elected representatives. It's almost, and I think, as to my knowledge, it's impossible to be able to veto or direct the parliament, because the elected representatives are there to make those decisions on behalf of their constituents. So that was always going to be a problem. Where do you get the power? Where do you get the power to actually start shifting the parliament? Actually start shifting some of the decisions and informing those decisions so that they better represent the interests of our mob. And so this idea of having a voice that would, scrutinise legislation, scrutinise policy and give input into those, the idea of where the power would come from is that over time this would seem to be as something that was a real benefit to lawmaking in this country. It would actually be seen as an asset to the parliament, actually something that would improve the decision making of the parliament, because we have to look at it now and say, look, it's struggling. We're really struggling. Look at the last 10 years of the Closing the Gap, you know, this year in the 10th year of the Closing the Gap, the former Prime Minister Turnbull announced that only 3 out of the 7 targets are on track.
The whole amalgamation of the Indigenous Advancement Strategy into
all of those issues,
all of those,
and we've seen all of the reports, the National Audit Office, and all of these reports into the terrible functioning and the terrible results that plays on our people. So yeah, there were those concerns raised about the advice, but there was also a sense that actually there's a real benefit in having a standing political voice that represents the voices of First Nations, and one that is connected to those First Nations on the ground, not some sort of just national body that was disconnected from the mob, but would have those connections all the way through, and that we need that to come together. Since that was disbanded in 2005, there's been a significant fracturing of our voice, and that's made it harder for us to express our genuine calls for self-determination and power that we need to start not just addressing the issues but properly taking our place in this country. So the idea of a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament, the constitutional protection was really important. A lot of people say, well, why do you bother about the Constitution? It sits right up there and it's way disconnected from grassroots mob. But we've seen what happens when we don't have that protection for our organisation. ATSIC was done away with the stroke of the ministerial pen. One day it was there, the next day it wasn't.
Didn't Vanstone come out and say, might have been a bit of a mistake?
She did.
She's on the panel, isn't she?
She was on the referendum council. It was a shame that she also didn't go that further step and say that mistake set back our efforts at self-determination and closing the gap by a few decades. That would have been a nice admission too. But the fact is, this constitutional protection would mean that would never happen to us again. Ministers, change of government, change of policy, it'd be their standing political voice representing the interests of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Do you think ATSIC in some ways had more power than potentially a voice to Parliament? Because they had a budget, and they was able to sort of actually allocate funding and, you know, drive what the priorities were in a very practical sense.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting argument. Nobody's ruled anything in or out yet in terms of the design, the details of what the voice to Parliament will or won't do. But certainly the lack of that constitutional protection meant that the body that was supposed to represent our strongest effort at self-determination just got pushed aside. just pushed aside without a thought of what would replace it, without a thought of, you know, how are we going to fill the gaps in those service delivery and the regional structures that were working really, really well and that were really engaged and connected to their communities. So I think there's space there for us to imagine and create what this voice to Parliament will actually do, and for us to work out, well, what is the best things that we need it to do so that we're impacting the lives in a positive way of our mob that are out there in the communities, because that's what this is all about. We're only talking about the constitutional reform so that the lives of families and our mob and our communities are better off than what they are at the moment.
Mm. And I guess, like, over the last few years as well, there's sort of been this big discussion, like, around treaty as well. Was that sort of a big thing at Uluru as well that was brought up and discussed?
That was the fifth option.
Yeah, okay.
And so the fifth option was agreement making, which is treaty or treaties.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there wasn't any decision on one treaty or multiple treaties. I think personally, having been in all the dialogues and been at Uluru, I think there was certainly a very strong appetite for First Nations to negotiate their own agreements with the governments that they need. Mm. So it sort of steered away from one blanket treaty, but there, you know, there are people that support that idea too. But I think there was really strong. It's about empowering First Nations in their places, on their country and on their waters, for them to be able to negotiate those agreements themselves directly. But this idea of that emerged out of Uluru, out of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, a Makarrata Commission, and that commission would effectively set the framework so that there was consistency across the country about the way that those negotiations would unfold. And I think there's a strong examples of why that's needed now. You know, the Victorian mob down there are really embarking on their treaty negotiations there. Jill Gallagher, the Treaty Commissioner, wonderful, powerful leader down there that's driving that forward. And, you know, they've got their Victorian election coming up, and so we hope that you know, is their treaty negotiations are supported and not affected by that. The South Australians embarked on their own treaty process.
They were
until then. There was a change of government.
Yeah.
The Liberal government came in and decided to discontinue that process.
I think New South Wales, they didn't. The opposition,
Luke Foley,
yes,
has talked about treaty there. The Northern Territory government has entered into an MOU with the land councils in the Northern Territory.
And then here as well?
Yeah, I believe recently Jackie Trad, it might have been, that talked about, you know, investigating what treaty might look like here in Queensland too. So the interesting thing that I think came out of the dialogues and out of Uluru was this issue of sequencing of the reforms being really important. And there was a lot of debate about this, but what emerged was this idea of, let's get the voice to Parliament locked in, let's get it in the Constitution so it can't be moved, so that when we do the harder conversation about treaty making, there is an anchor that's stuck there that can't be moved, because treaty is going to be a much harder conversation than a voice to Parliament. And I think the conversations around recognition of sovereignty and what that entails for our inability to enjoy and exercise our own sovereignty since 1788, what that means for the country going forward, these are hard decisions and these are hard conversations to be had.
But isn't that, like, that's just the discussion between us, isn't a discussion, I guess, to change constitutional recognition, to have that part, isn't that a discussion that needs to involve the majority of Australia?
Correct, yep. So you need to, there's two hurdles that you need to win. So you need a referendum to change the constitution, and there are two hurdles to win a referendum. One is you need the majority of voters, and then the second hurdle is that you need a majority of the voters in the majority of the states. So we need to win 4 out of 6 states, as well as the majority of the voters.
And something like that hasn't happened since 67.
Difficult to get up, aren't they, referenda?
77. Was the last successful referendum.
For us.
No, 67 was the last one for us.
Yeah, it was the only one for us.
Yeah. 77 was the last successful referendum for any question. So, yeah, it's difficult. And you know, we've probably heard in history, you know, only 8 out of 44 of the referendum questions that have ever been put to the Australian people since 1901 have been successful. But the point I like to make too is we are in an unprecedented time here in our history. This is easily the longest amount of time that we as a nation have gone since the last successful referendum. And there's never been a referendum that has been fought and won in the social media age and the internet age. And so I think there are obviously history lessons, but we can't be bound by those history lessons because in some ways the environment that we're living in now, nobody's ever, ever run a referendum in that environment either.
Do you think that's going to be easier or harder? Because, I mean, this whole thing I feel like started with the Recognise campaign and that became quickly a very controversial topic, yeah? Mm. And I think the whole thing with the Recognise, as you touched on before, was that token recognition, yeah? Like words in a preamble and clearly the conversation's moved on from there. You know, this is about something substantive. It's about something tangible, yeah? But I think there's still this like convoluted perspectives all yep. around recognition or constitutional reform. It's a hard task to sort of to clear the pathway, I think.
So I think there are make 2 points on that. One, with regard to recognise, and you know, we encountered it a lot in the referendum council process, a lot of dissatisfaction from the mob about recognise and what it was doing. And I'm not going to make a comment either way on its effectiveness or otherwise. I think the difference between recognise and now is there's a concrete proposal on the table that has been articulated by the mob in terms of what constitutional reform should look like. Recognise never had that. Recognise had a general kind of question about should we recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the constitution. And I don't think that did them any favours. But as I say, I'm not going to cast judgment either way because... you know, they had a job to do and they did that. But the second point about will it be easier or harder now in this particular age, I've taken a lot of comfort and hope from the marriage equality issue. Yes, that was a plebiscite, so different to a referendum, not compulsory. You don't have to win the states. You just have to basically get the majority of the voters. And I think they got something like 61%. Of nearly over 80% of people actually voted. So, I think the politicians badly misread the Australian public. I think particularly conservative politicians thought that there was this great big silent majority that was sitting out there ready to vote no. And I think it shows how disconnected they are from the Australian people that the yes vote was 61% and the no vote 39%. And so I know that they're different issues, but I think it said something along the lines of, if we organise ourselves well, we get out there and we get on the front foot and we show to the Australian people that voice to Parliament, while yes, it is absolutely about getting the voices of First Nations closer to the power and closer to the decision-making in this country, the Uluru Statement from the Heart is ultimately something that's going to make this country better for all of us. Mm. And I think there's a bigger message in there that goes beyond just us mob that says, if we get this right, we achieve Makarrata, we achieve treaty, we do the truth-telling process that came out of the Uluru Statement, we're going to be looking at a fundamentally different country, one where we are actually taking our rightful place. And I think that people are looking to Canberra at the moment and they're seeing nothing but dysfunction, division and pettiness. And the Uluru Statement is visionary. It's hopeful. It says something about what we should be as a country. And I think people... keen for that conversation to be had. So I've got optimism. I think it's easy to be pessimistic. I've got optimism about our prospects in this. And I think the possibility for the longer term change to what we'll do in this country is something worth fighting for.
And then with that as well, you know, there's this massive big distrust, you know, from our people when it comes to policies, when it comes to government. And then, you know, everything that runs off of that, and then the continuation of, you know, what continues to happen to our people. Mm. You know, there's this, you know, where do we go with sort of that discussion then?
Yeah, look, that was absolutely a live thing that happened in all the dialogues. You know, our mob aren't silly.
Mm.
You know, they've seen these things come before.
Mm.
They've seen the hopes raised before. There was cynicism, considerable cynicism in a lot of these dialogues. You know, would the system listen? Would the system change as a result of what we did? So they went in there with their eyes wide open, but they did it anyway. They did it anyway because they saw this as another opportunity for us to put it out there to try and bridge that gap between us and the rest of the country, and extended a very, very generous invitation that, you know, we could have been, it wouldn't have been a great surprise if you had seen the mob turn around and go, nah, too much of an ask. We've been asked to do this before. They didn't. And I think, you know, we can't be naive about this. Our mob, you know, I heard Warren Snowden talk the other day, and he said something along the lines of that we don't understand the real politics of thing, that we're somehow a little bit naive. And I just thought, hang on, our mob live the politics every single day of our lives. Mm. We are not naive. We understand the real nastiness and the real kind of steep hill that we have to climb on a daily basis. I think it's right to be cynical, but I also think we will get this over the line if we are able to also be hopeful. And I know, because I heard people talk about their hope for what our place could be like in this country. The old people have only fought their battles for us in many different ways because they could imagine a future better for us. They could imagine a future that's better than what they achieved. And I think that's all part of our stewardship as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We don't think about this in the next 5 or 10 years. We think about the generations and millennia of generations that have come before us. And we think about those that are yet to come. And we look at our moment in this time and go, well, we're the custodians in this time in our history. What are we going to do to make sure that those next generations that come are better? And when you hear the old people talk about that and you think it's our turn to do that now, there's hope for us that we can actually make a better future for ourselves. And so, you know, I think we'll do this with our eyes wide open. There will be cynicism, there will be doubt, and we'll need that. We'll need that because we can't be naive. But I think we're also going to be driven by hope and belief as well.
Do you think there's a inevitability that regardless of a parliament, a voice to parliament, an ATSIC, that these issues go beyond machinations of government? That these issues are like are broader than, you know, having people stand up in parliament and state our case, having people, you know, having budgets. I mean, people have budgets and money to spend now, yeah? Mm. We could replace all the parliamentarians now with Indigenous people and politicians and that sort of stuff. One could argue it's a structural issue. We may still have the same problem because we're operating in a essentially in a foreign structure that these things occur in. Do you think that this may bring about some, I guess, reprieve from our issues, but longer term, are the issues that we suffer bigger than governments and parliaments?
The short answer is yes. There's a line in the Uluru Statement from the Heart that goes, you know, proportionally we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are aliened from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. And then it goes, these dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. And what you're talking about, Carver, when I understand the structural nature of our problems, I think of them in two elements. One is the stuff that you're talking about. It's the laws, the policies, the programs, the services, you know, everything that we talk about in Closing the Gap. That's one element of the structural nature. But the second element is the heart of it. It's the racism. It's the racism and the discrimination. And not just that, it's the fundamental misunderstanding and blindness and deafness to the value of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and our culture and our ways of being and knowing and doing that have survived for 60 millennia and more. It's the stuff that Uncle Bruce Pascoe talks about in terms of this blindness to the idea that actually we were cultivators and we looked after the land and we were the first farmers and you know, but actually the story that has been told of us is that we're this sort of primitive hunter-gatherer, and it's been a deliberate downplaying of who we are and our contribution to this country. So, yes, there's an element of the parliament and the machinery and the structures, but that is by no means the end of it. That is not sufficient by itself. This genuine, deep recognition, acknowledgement, and knowing the truth of who we are as people and what it means to have a flourishing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples central to the identity of this country, I think that's the bigger thing that we, you know, that's the bigger prize, that's the bigger vision that that we should be working towards.
Biting on the street one day, I saw a policeman. He come up to me and he did say, "What are you doing, son?" I said I didn't think that I was doing any harm. Then he went and moved me on. Said I was taking arms. Have you got arms for the beggar man? Have you got arms for the beggar man? Oh, they call me the beggar man. The beggar man.
And you're back on 98.9 FM. Hope you've been enjoying the show. We've had Brother Dean with us. He's been a part of the process for the what is known now as the Statement from the Heart, a big dialogue with around 250, almost 300 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from all over the country. We've been having a really, really good conversation. And I guess, you know, one of the main things you know, when we gather, when our mob come together, and this has been something that we've always had, you know, pre-colonization, we've always come together, there's always been disagreements. And obviously, you know, at Uluru, over this few days, there was disagreements as well.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And necessarily so. The issues that we're talking about are far too important for everybody to pretend that it's all just going to happen.
Work itself out.
With everyone's just going to work itself out, right? I mean, again, look at the parliament at the moment. Look at, not even the parliament, look at the coalition tearing itself apart.
Or even, you know, it started off with the Labour doing it, you know?
Yeah. Mm.
Knifing themselves.
Absolutely, right? And so
intervention in the parliament. No.
Let's do it. Yeah, look, and so there were disagreements, and people expressed those disagreements, and they made them well known, and there was a small walkout of people. I think it is important to recognise that that happened, but it was in the scheme of the people that were there. It was a small minority of people, and they're entitled to do that. They're entitled to express their view in a way that that meant that they were getting their view across. But also, the remaining 250 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were entitled also to reach a consensus, and that's what they did. So, but I also want to say, not everybody was involved in the referendum council dialogue process.
Mm.
Proportionally, it is the most comprehensive process to ever engage our mob. But it's not everybody, and there are still other people out there that have got different views. So we've got to recognise that, but we also got to recognise that more than 1,200 of our mob were involved in the dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
More than 250 people from those dialogues endorsed the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and I think we have to recognise that as a compelling mandate for change. We're never going to get everybody engaged in a process. It's just not going to happen. Mm. We need to still recognise and acknowledge those differing views, but also recognise that there is a consensus here, and there is a mandate to work towards that reform.
So what are the next steps in terms of you working towards this reform? I don't see Recognise around much these days, in terms of the brand and the R and all that sort of stuff. What are the next steps? I know that there's a couple of Senate committees.
Yeah,
committees.
That's right.
So what
happened was, I wasn't involved in Recognise, but I think they were effectively disbanded in about July last year or June, July, something like that. So that's why you haven't seen them around. Referendum Council submitted its final report following Uluru to the government and the opposition leader. The Turnbull Cabinet rejected the Referendum Council's final report in October last year. I'd say it was not surprising necessarily that they rejected it. I think it was surprising in the manner in which it was rejected. I think it just showed a deep lack of respect, and it did not dignify, as I said, the work that our mob put into that as a genuine, heartfelt, and intellectually robust proposal to move our situation forward. And so that was just utterly disrespected. Interestingly, the Turnbull government then, with Labor, established what they call a joint select committee. That's been co-chaired by Senator Pat Dodson on the Labor side and Julian Lisa, who's a Member of Parliament with the Coalition. And they were effectively tasked with looking at all the other things that we'd done before, all the stuff that we'd already done at Uluru and the Referendum Council and rehashing all of that. They released a report in the end of July.
They're still getting around doing talks and stuff, though, eh?
They are.
Yeah, they are still
talking to people.
Yeah.
So they released a report at the end of July, which actually basically said, you know what, the dialogue process was comprehensive and it did reflect the views of those people that were involved in that process, this idea of a constitutionally enshrined First Nations voice to Parliament, and acknowledge all of that work. They're due to submit their final report at the end of November. And so it'll be interesting to see, the outcome of that report and what they will recommend to the government. I think there's a couple of challenges or potential risks for us in that process. One is that, and I think the main challenge, is that the constitutional enshrinement, which our mob was so insistent upon throughout that whole process, to give us that certainty, to lock it in, is going to be seen as too hard, and that potentially they'll propose just a legislative approach, so just a normal old-fashioned...
So back to ATSIC sort of thing.
Back to the the vulnerability of an organisation that can be tipped over by a minister at their whim. And I think we need to be really, you know, and to your point about being cynical and not being naive before Bo, I think we've got to be a little bit cynical at the moment and not see that as a little win, not see that as a step. Because if it gets put into law without the constitutional protection, there's a strong sense that constitutional reform for our mob will be dead, because I think a couple of things will happen. If the voice to Parliament is to work well and it's to really be effective, it's got to be critical of government. It's got to criticise bad laws and bad policies, and it's got to put them under the microscope. And if it does that, there's not going to be any government, regardless of what political stripe, is then going to want to say, well, let's put it in the Constitution, because they're not going to like being on the end of that criticism. So that's one challenge. But there's another challenge too, is if it is successful and it starts to work really, really well, which I'm sure that it will, people will go, ah, well, you don't need the referendum, you don't need the constitutional protection. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, which will work until a government comes in and decides that they don't want to see it again. So I think we've got to resist this idea that legislation first with some sort of vague promise for constitutional enshrinement later on, we've got to resist the idea that that is a good win or is a good step in the right direction. We should be pushing for the constitutional enshrinement. We should be pushing for this to be put to the Australian people so that we can get that certainty, so that we can really then address some of the challenging issues that we've got going forward.
How confident are you? Do you reckon this is going to... Is it going to get the support to be able to put to a referendum? Like, clearly the response so far hasn't been good.
Well, I think if you go back to the original notion of the Uluru Statement, it's not a submission or a petition to the government. It's an invitation to the people of Australia. And so I think on this particular issue, I think, and I've been going around and talking to a lot of people about the process and Uluru Statement and what it means and what it can mean for us as a country. And when you talk to people, average Australians, they get it. They understand it. It makes perfect sense. It's not threatening. They see it for what it is, which is a genuine step by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to try and move us as a country forward. I think the Australian people are out in front of the politicians on this, and I think we need to continue to have a conversation with them, because I think they will be the ones that push the politicians into place. So we've got to keep working on the politics of it, absolutely. We wouldn't drop that, but I think we've got to have that conversation with the Australian people, because I think, I think that they will shift the parliament.
The plebiscite took a while.
But none of the change that happens in our space happens quickly. And none of it happens without struggle. Nothing is ever given. Nothing is ever given to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We have to struggle.
You get free cars, free education, all them things. Haven't you heard? Yeah.
I must have missed out on all that.
That's what I tell them. Tell me where the line is.
Tell me exactly right. Yeah, but no, you know, we're not strangers to these things taking time, and we're not strangers to struggle. So, you know, again, listening to the old people and telling us about the way that these things work, we've got to think generationally, and that's hard for us, but we're used to it, and we'll go again. And we'll go again, because we're not going away. We're not going away. It's too important for us.
There was a really good piece that Rachel Perkins did that she actually spoke about all the... In one way, shape or form, you know, all of our mob throughout history have all spoken about this, you know, going back to William Cooper and, you know, right up through to the Bark petitions and them things,
If we stopped every time the system or governments told us to stop, we will have achieved nothing. But we have. We've achieved many great things in many communities around the country, and it's because people strive and they fight and they struggle, and we're going to do that again. It's part of our heritage, unfortunately. It's part of the legacy that's been left to us, and it's the one that we'll leave to the next generation, because we're not going to win all these battles in our generation. There's going to be more to be fought. But we're not strangers to that, and I don't think we're fearful of it. So, you know, I think we've got to have that hope and belief in ourselves. Yeah.
And resolve.
Definitely. Big thanks for joining us in the studio this morning too, Russ. It was really good to have you in there.
Thank you very much for having me. Absolutely appreciate it. Thank you.
And if you've enjoyed the program, you can catch the repeat 7 p.m. tonight on 98.9 FM, or you can head to 98.9fm.com.au and the podcast will be up on our website to listen at, you know, whenever you feel like it, your own leisure, and also other shows that we produce here at 98.9 FM.